Welcome to the Half Percent Podcast. Each episode is an interview with a member of the armed forces, whether active duty, vet, or reserve. You can find this show wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe and give us a review. You can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at the Half Percent Podcast. Please give the show a follow. And without further ado, let's get into the show.
Okay, Mr. Push-ups, let's hear your story.
It's not just the uniform. It's the stories that you tell. So much fun and imagination.
From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Welcome back to the Half Percent Podcast. My guest today is Kay Paul. Kay is currently serving in the United States Air Force. Kay, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for making the time. Let's get right into it. Where you're from and why you decided to go into the Air Force.
So I am from North Carolina originally, and I grew up, I always wanted to fly. And I actually started off thinking I wanted to go to the Navy, like all good kids growing up in the 80s, you know, Top Gun was a huge thing. So when I was 16 and a half, maybe 17, I tried to lie my way into getting into the Navy enlisted, and my mom caught me and the recruiter caught me. And she had my uncle, who at the time was still a actively serving captain in the Navy, sit me down and basically talk me out of it. So between the two of them, they talked me out of enlisting in the Navy. I agreed with them that I would go to 1 year of school. The school that I selected didn't have a Navy ROTC program. So I went Air Force because that's another great way to start flying. Yep. Got there, got a scholarship. And due to the scholarship, I was told I had to enlist in the Ready Reserves. And so I enlisted on August 20th of 2001. And then the rest, as they say, is history. Commissioned in 2004.
Yeah. And you mentioned to your mom that nothing was going to happen, of course, in August of 2001. And then
1 month later. Yeah. So my mom, a lover, super left leaning, hippie type, you know, she was not happy that I wanted to go into the military. Even when I said, it's okay, I'm going to go in the Air Force. It'll be totally safe. that all made a liar out of me. And a month later, you know, my mom and I are both sobbing on the phone. Oh God, what's happening in this world? But, you know, as I alluded to earlier, my mom was a flight attendant at that point in time for 30 years. When she finally retired, it was 40. And so she actually knew the crew that was on the American flight.
I was just about to say, I saw that and saw that she worked for American. So I would imagine that hit home for her.
It really did. And so, you know, after that, when we did finally get connection, because, you know, like on Tuesday, nobody's cell phones was working. All the cell phone lines were jammed. So I think I finally got a hold of her on Wednesday, and we talked. And, you know, from that Wednesday, from September 12th on, I've never heard another bad word against the military. And she's been incredibly supportive of my career.
Interesting. Yeah, well, as a son of two hippies that met each other at UC Berkeley in the 60s, I can attest to that when I told my mom I was going into the Marine Corps in 2004, she almost fell over, but later on kind of came around to the idea. So, it's interesting. Your parents, at the end of the day, most of them do support you if you stick to it and show that it's something good that in your life, you know?
Yeah.
Cool deal. So where's your first stop in the Air Force in terms of boot camp and all that stuff? Where do you go first?
So I went through ROTC. So, you know, you just do the standard ROTC pipeline. And I actually, so coming into NAV school, there was a wait. They had so many people that, you know, a lot of lieutenants were getting sat down and, you know, like you hung out in somebody else's flying squadron for a while. So I went to Little Rock Air Force Base to a C-130 unit. And, you know, I hung out with the C-130 bubbas for a while and got to know them. And it was nice because I got to know a lot more about aviation that I might not have otherwise. And I also learned there that aviators are crazy people. Absolutely bonkers. And I decided I wanted to be absolutely like that. Like I
was going to say, was that a selling point for you?
I think it was.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So at this point, what are you doing in terms of job wise? What are you doing in the early parts of your career at Little Rock?
I actually sat in the back and I operated a mobility shop, which basically meant that I was a paperwork pusher. Okay. You know, people would get ready to deploy and they would come to me, and because I'm, you know, this shiny brand new butter bar and I don't know anything about anything, but I can run a spreadsheet like a champion.
There we go.
Yep. So I sat there as like a paperwork pusher, just making sure that everybody's clearances and currencies and shot records were all up to date so that they could go deploy. Because C-130s at the time, you know, they were just deploying all the time.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. Okay. So once you commission, what changes for you?
Money.
besides the money, that's right.
Oh man, I had a real job. I had a regular paycheck. I had furniture in my house. I didn't have to eat ramen noodles, although I still did, and I still do.
Right.
You know, like you can never give up your ramen noodles.
Right.
So I think that was one of the things. The other thing too, I think it helped give me more structure to my life. You know, I grew up with a single mom. I had a little brother, and it's not to say that we were feral, but you know, my mom is the flight attendant. She's leaving for 3 days out of every week. And, you know, we basically have just a string of babysitters that come in and take care of us. But, you know, I got really used to being accountable only to myself. And then I go out to college and I'm really accountable only to myself, only if I, you know, have to go to class. And now I'm in a, you know, very rigid and very structured. I'm going to get up and I got to go to work and I got to do all these things. And, you know, starting to understand the consequences of my actions. And that just because, you know, this is your stated job, finally understanding, oh, wow, there's a lot of other things that nobody tells you you have to do, but you better do it. Like you better get your fitness in order, and you know, you'd better be a stand-up person. You can't be off, you know, drinking to all hours of the night and then come in, you know, dragging into work.
Yeah, that's college, man, not in the Navy.
Yeah, that was college. Well, you know, though, like I said, C-130 squadron and people be buck wild. I watched a couple people, you know, really tiptoe right up to that line. And then, you know, some of them kind of got their wrists slapped, and I learned by watching them mess up that, hey, man, that's not anything I ever want to have happen to me. And so, you know, it really helped me kind of grow up and be an adult and learn how to be a professional.
Yeah. You have a lot of people relying on you, and rely, and also a lot of money riding on a lot of funds and people, you know, all of a sudden you become a cog in a very large machine. So, you gotta pull your weight. Absolutely. And I've heard that over and over from people who joined. It helped them get that very firmly clear in their head. So, well, cool. Okay. And then, so at this time, how long were you at the base in Little Rock?
I think I was only there like 8 months. So basically June to about January, February. And then I actually ended up just down the road from where I'm at now. Ended up at Pensacola to do nav school. And I'm really glad that I spent that 8 months growing up, because nav school would have been a rude awakening otherwise.
Because
it was hard. Not like physically demanding, but it's mentally demanding, and it is a rigid class structure.
And how long is that school?
At the time, it was set up to be about a 14-month program.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So, okay. And then you get done with that school, and what's your next stop?
My next stop, I did a 4-month TDY to do just kind of some top-off training. Which was good and bad. It was unexpected. The aircraft I got was not the aircraft I thought I was going to get. And so I didn't think I was going to have to go to this extra school. But at some point in time while I was in Randolph in Texas, I'm down in the basement of the O Club, and I am running around playing a game called CRUD, which if you've never heard of CRUD before, it's a bunch of young chest-beating Air Force officers running around a pool table, basically throwing pool balls at each other. Yeah, like, so you're trying to use one ball to knock other balls in, and it's very combative. I had rolled in, I don't know where I was before, but I wasn't exactly like in uniform or anything. It's Friday night after work. And apparently I was wearing a mini skirt and a tank top. I don't really remember that part because, you know, my clothing was inconsequential to me. However, I have been repeatedly told that that's what I'm wearing, because that's how my husband first met me. I was running barefoot around this pool table pretending like I'm a 300-pound linebacker when I was, you know, at the time I'm like a 120 soaking wet, in a tank top and a mini skirt and just checking dudes into a wall. So while I was not super excited to be at that training, I met my husband, so I can't really say that it was a bad thing for me.
And you learned a very edifying game there, man. Crud.
I did, yeah. Like I mean, I played that for probably another decade after that.
Some bruises and bumps and all that. I didn't know Air Force.
Broken
I didn't know
Air Force. And I got knocked a tooth out. I'm not kidding. What I say, I think I'm a 300-pound linebacker.
I didn't know Air Force got down like that. But. That's it. I'm telling you, this is why I love the show. You learn something new every time. That's a crud. I'll take that with me. All right, so talk about, you know, the bulk of your job to the extent that you can at that time. Did you deploy to the Middle East? What are things that are Asia or wherever you deployed in? What sticks out for you in terms of stories and things like that?
So I actually, you know, like one of the things we finished up training and moved to our first base, and we were supposed to deploy, I think, in like October of 2007. But on August 20th, 30th, something like that of, or no, July, I think. I don't know. It's been well over a decade at this point. But they had the accidental transfer of nuclear weapons. And all of a sudden, my deployment got turned off.
Whoa.
And our whole unit got sat down for a year, even though it wasn't us. Like, that was not our unit at all. But they sat us down, and that deployment rolled 4 months, and then it rolled 6 months. And then, in the end, it had rolled about a year, which had a huge impact personally and professionally when, you know, everybody gets ready for this deployment. And you know how it is with a deployment. Like, you kind of start making your life plans, and you build them around a deployment. Right. So this guy who had seen me checking people into a wall in Randolph, you know, I'd followed him to Minot. We both went up to Minot Air Force Base. And I said, hey, man, I moved up here for you, but you need to put a ring on it. And we're going to go through this deployment. And by the time we come back, if you don't know what your answer is, then that's the answer. And I'm out. Well, now this deployment starts rolling, and he's like, oh, haha, I got you. Like, I got a full extra year, and I'm mad. I'm mad as hell. So he ended up proposing like 6 months later, and then it was this crazy rush to get a wedding in order so that we could get married before the deployment. So I got married like 6 weeks before my first deployment.
Okay. And then you're out. And then that deployment, Middle East at that time?
Nope. At that time, our unit was really only going out into the South Pacific.
Okay.
Yeah, so we spent a beautiful 5 months in the South Pacific, escaped a Minot winter for the tropics.
I was going to say, bad. Man, that you got a hell of a, you got a great deal out of that one from North Dakota to the South Pacific. That's a good trade.
Oh God, man! So I have I've done three deployments out there. Every single one of them has been in the wintertime.
Nice.
Which is good and bad. Like, it's great because you escape the northern tier in the winter. The bad thing is we usually leave right before Halloween, and we usually get back right after Valentine's Day. So I think I'm up to like four or five deployed Thanksgivings and Christmases, you know, like, so I missed a lot of holidays.
Yeah, but you got great stories to tell in later holidays when you're done with your service. You know, I spent one time I was on an island in Guam for Thanksgiving type deal. So that's good. And so at this point, I'm gonna ask you about zombies in Guam.
Heck yeah. Okay. So on my second deployment out there, we were getting our air crew ready for close air support for CAS and doing training for that. And so, you know, I've only got so many jets. I can only put so many people up in the air at a time. So basically, we would put about half the squadron airborne and the other half would be on the ground. And they wanted us operating in, you know, like a mock urban environment, because at the time, all the places we'd go for combat deployments, you know, it was urban environments, you know, you're chasing people through that. And you got to be able to work the targeting pod and those kinds of things around buildings. So on Guam, you have Anderson Air Force Base, and then you have Anderson South, which is now the like closed defunct base. and we're running around on the ground working with actual JTACs, and they've got us like basically as op four, and we're going out and we're running around through these dilapidated buildings. I don't know how anybody thought it was okay for us to do this, because those things looked like they were ready to collapse. And every time you would turn around, somebody would open a door to another room and come walking in, and, you know, like, because this is the base that time has forgotten, you just like, it looks like a zombie, you know, because of course at the time Walking Dead had just come out, and we're all like, oh god, it's zombies, and it's Twilight, and there's like snakes and spider webs, and it's just like nasty dilapidated buildings. And so, you know, like, we basically all just turned it into like one big giant zombie hunting mission for us on the ground. And then the guys that are airborne are like trying to figure out where we've gone to. And, you know, by that point in time, the communications up to the jet had just gotten absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, I got four by zombies moving up a hardball road, you know, they're moving on a north south, you know. And the guys in the air are like, what the hell are you talking about, zombies, man?
It sounds like a giant game of like zombie laser tag rather than something, right? That the Air Force, yeah, was doing. Right,
yeah, pretty much.
That sounds fun. That's actually sounds kind of fun.
It was.
so you mentioned you had three deployments to Asia during your career, and those were spaced over quite a few years, I'd imagine, or all bunched up, or
it was about every other year.
Okay. What was your favorite place over there?
My favorite place, or what I'm really going to tell you.
Well, I can only go what you tell me, but you probably should tell me what your favorite place is.
Okay. There was a tiny little sushi bar that we used to go to.
Right.
At the time, the government vehicles, you could only take them out to eat or to your place of worship or to acquire more food. So we had a sushi bar that we would go to that we really liked. And of course, you know, then you park the vehicle at the sushi bar. And if you happen to wander somewhere else, then, you know, just don't get caught.
There's a very wide definition of what going to get more food means, right?
Right, yes.
Right,
gotcha. There may or may not have been a time we parked in front of the, I think it's like the Yigo Market. They have like a big fish market. Uh-huh. Parked down there at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we went fishing. And if anybody asks, we were going out for groceries. It just takes a really long time to catch those fish.
Technically, you are not lying.
Yep, it's all about the technicalities.
Right, exactly. Awesome. And then talk a little bit about anything else in terms of combat deployments or anything like that, stories that stick out to you that you can tell us about?
Nothing on the combat deployments side that I'm going to talk about. Okay. I do have one Middle East deployment from, it's been a couple of years now, but it went well, but it also went like really not well. So, I don't know if you follow my Twitter account, but, you know, I've talked about some of the things that, you know, I'm still dealing with after that one. But at least the good part is, even though, you know, bad things happened and I have had to deal with it, I've been using it to help other people. Because, you know, like once you've fallen into that hole and climbed back out, like, you know the way back out. And if somebody else falls in the hole, you can reach that hand down and be like, hey man, I'll help you out. Like, I know what this is like. So while I wish that those things had never happened, in some ways I'm kind of glad that it did, because I have that, you know, that I can help with now. And it comes out in my writing too. You know, I talked about, I've got the book, and, you know, anybody that's read the book has seen, you know, that's layered in there as well, how you can have bad things happen in your life and still keep fighting through and still keep living your life, as long as you keep working on it.
That's right. Yeah. And whether it happened or not, or whether you wanted it to happen or not, it did happen, and it also makes you who you are. And that's, you know, inexorably part of who you are. So,
yeah, absolutely.
For all the good and bad. And it sounds like really, really good in your case in terms of what you've turned it into, which is awesome. Yeah. Okay. And then talk a little bit about people's conceptions of what you do in the Air Force as opposed to what it is. Other than obviously, you know, late night fishing trips in Japan and chasing zombies in Guam, but you know, what have you run into in terms of civilians and in terms of what you do and as opposed to what you actually do?
Well, I think the biggest misconception I have with civilians, I don't know, maybe I don't see it as much now, but I definitely remember early on, it was a lot of, oh, hey, you're in the Air Force? My cousin's best friend's aunt is, you know, in the Air Force. Do you know Jane? She's at such and such base. I'm like, nope, No idea. I have no idea who that is. You know, everybody just assumes the military is really, really small.
Right.
And it's, you know, everybody just assumes you all know each other. Right. So that was always kind of funny. I think everybody assumes that everyone in the Air Force is a pilot. Mm-hmm. They assume that anybody wearing a flight suit is a pilot, which isn't always the case. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, it's interesting too, in the military, you know, you've got kind of like your hierarchy, your pecking order of who's cooler and, you know, who does the neat things.
That's right.
And it's gotten to the point where I think that is so prevalent that even the civilians start picking up on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes I'll tell people, you know, what I do in my job, and I'll either get like this eye roll, or I'll get that like little squint where they look at you like, really? I totally thought you were cooler than that. Like, okay, you come do this job. You come tell me how cool it is.
Well, as my Marine recruiter says, listen, man, it takes about 7 of us to get one guy to the front to do the things you think you're going to do. So your chances of being a recon Marine and, you know, being whatever are pretty small. So you better figure out something else to do. So, yeah, I hear you on that for sure. And so you've been in since 2001. Altogether, how's your views of the service changed over the years?
So I think it's interesting how everyone's view seems to change. I've seen a lot of people that get really cynical, you know, they really get beaten down, and some of them, I think the cynicism is valid, but they let it eat away at them. For me, I think I've seen my view change, but my optimism has stayed. And I think part of that just comes from I've seen shifts in the culture of the military. So, you know, mm-hmm. early on, especially in an aviation unit, you know, like I said, there's that hierarchy of who's in the pecking order, who's the second and third class citizens. And, you know, and when I started, it didn't matter what type of wings you wore. If you were a woman in an aviation squadron, man, you were already automatically the bottom of the list. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter how good you were at your job.
Right.
And now that really seems to have gone away. I think there's much more value given to someone's technical expertise and their skills, and people are willing to take you for what you can do and what you bring to the fight rather than who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think seeing changes like that really is what has helped me keep my optimism and be happy with all the changes that have been made.
Right. And then this is, since you're active duty, this is going to be, you can go the super diplomatic route, but I'll ask it anyway. What does the Air Force do really well, and what does it not do well?
Ooh.
Be as diplomatic as you want, of course.
I think one of the biggest, for me, for the Air Force versus any of the other services, I think the Air Force's reliance on technological solutions is actually both. I think the fact that they lean forward, that they've got their, you know, the current, you know, accelerate, change, or lose, it shows that we really do consider, hey, I can't just rest on my laurels. I can't just look at the last fight. I can't just look at the latest, you know, the last piece of technology that worked. I've got to look at what's coming down the road and 20 years down the road and plan for that. And so I think that's really, it's good for them, but sometimes it's to their detriment too, because there's so much change that, you know, bureaucratically, we can't always keep up with it.
Right, right. Yeah, like any big organization, at the end of the day, it's it is going to be some DMV like tendencies come up the works every so often. Do you feel like you've really been challenged in that way? And if obviously you have a good attitude towards your service, and you probably have gotten the most out of it, but do you feel like you've been challenged in the Air Force?
Oh yeah, definitely. Some of it, you know, is just what was inherent to the Air Force. Some of it is, I like to take challenges on to myself. So, you know, what was the next school? What was the next step? You know, what was the next upgrade? I was always that person that was, you know, I'm hitting the books because I want to be selected early for something. I want to, you know, hit the books so that I get picked up for the one super selective school, you know, or the super, you know, prestigious position that's going to get me to that next thing.
Right.
So yeah, I was always after the next challenge.
Awesome. Awesome. So, okay, let's get to your writing. Now, you are the author of a novel, Pantheon. Talk about, have you always written since you were a kid? Is that something that came later in life?
Oh yeah, no, I've been writing since I was a kid. I've bet if you ask my mom, she's probably got like my earliest stories somewhere written in crayon. and then like all good high schoolers, teenagers, you know, I started off in the world of fan fiction. So
of course.
I love seeing it come up on social media. You'll see some person poo-pooing fan fiction. I'm like, man, do you know how many authors get their start there? And so it's been interesting watching how things have changed. So 10, maybe 11, 12 years ago, I had a whole novel written out and I was, you know, going through the process because at the time it was, there was a lot of gatekeepers. You know, you've got to find your literary agent and then the literary agent has to represent you to a publishing house. And there's really only six. And then like each one had 20 different imprints, you know, that were based on a genre. And man, if you couldn't get your foot in the door with that literary agent, you were done. And so I'd spend weekends, you know, writing up queries and sending out little excerpts from my book. And man, I couldn't get any traction. And when I did, it would inevitably come back with the same thing almost every time. It was, you're a good writer, you show potential, but unless you can commit to producing one book every 18 months, you're not commercially viable. And man, that was soul crushing to be told that you're good enough, but if you can't do it fast enough, then we don't want you.
Right.
And so, and I hate this, I've related this to people before, but the woman that wrote 50 Shades of Grey, I think her name is, E.L. James. I kind of have to thank her because if it hadn't been for her and 50 Shades of Grey, I might not have got into the industry. Because really? When 50 Shades of Grey came out, Amazon was really just starting to get into the ebooks. And so when 50 Shades of Grey came out, now you've got like every soccer mom sitting around practice with her little Kindle or her Nook.
Oh, telling me, man.
And she's flipping through that book and she is reading the dirtiest, smuttiest stuff you can ever imagine. But nobody knows because the backside of that Kindle, the backside of that Nook, the back of your phone doesn't show a cover. And so it, like, they realized how many people were buying that as an ebook because of the anonymity of what you were reading.
Right.
And all of a sudden the like ebook market just exploded. And so now the publisher that I'm with, they go through both routes. They do they do the ebooks, they do the paperbacks. And I think that, you know, that publishing company is part of this sort of like new generation of hybrid publishing companies. And so if it hadn't been for that real boom in e-publishing, I might not have ever gotten a contract.
Thank goodness for smutty, smutty middle-aged housewife porn, gosh. Man. Like I coached basketball for 10 years, man, and talk about literally looking up in the stands and you'd see mothers getting hot under the collar with their Nooks and the
that is what they were reading.
That is a true story, man. That is an absolute true story. And shout out to Daniel Charles Ross, by the way, man. He was been a guest on this show, and thanks for linking us two up. So, because he is your publisher, correct?
Yes, he is.
Cool. All right. So talk about Pantheon real quick.
Every time I get that question, I always panic. I'm like, oh my God, how do I describe the story? Because, you know,
what's your elevator pitch? One sentence. No.
One sentence or less is logisticians who can teleport are superheroes.
Okay.
Nice. So you've got Air Force officer realizes that, she's got superpowers. And rather than trying to hide it, actually goes up front about it, tells her boss, and boss is like, hey, cool, come with me. Here's your stack of read-ins. Here's your new boss. Go have fun. And so she gets recruited into, basically it's like Doctors Without Borders, except for logisticians. So if you can teleport anywhere in the world, and you can teleport anyone or anything, there's military applications to that.
Right.
Of course, how does she find out that she's got these superpowers? She has a very traumatic event. And so you've got this cool superhero story going in, fighting the Russians, stopping a plot, you know, against the U.S. But on top of that and layered in with that, you also have the story of, like I was talking about earlier, when you have something bad like that happen, you can still fight through it as long as you're getting that help. And so you kind of like, I wrote that, you know, they always tell you like, write the book you want to read and be the leader that you needed. And this is almost kind of both, like in my perfect world, if I could go back, you know, what did I need and what did I want to know? It's that even though you can be fighting through these things, it's okay that you still need help. You could be that superhero, and it's okay to still accept help. So I really liked that I layered that in. There's another book coming. I don't have a publishing date yet, but it's going to keep down that same vein of, you know, you got your little team of superheroes, but things happened at the end of the first book, and there's still a lot of people having to deal with what happened there. How did that impact? And, you know, how are people reacting? And it's all kind of threaded and interlaced in there.
Very cool. Very cool. And how's, like, do you find that, you know, with your fellow airmen in the Air Force, are there writers, do you talk about that with them, or is that something you kind of keep separate?
So yes and no. I do try to keep it separate from my work life. But because of the job that I have, and the fact that, you know, like anybody that holds a security clearance, there are certain things that you have to tell the security folks.
Of course.
And of course, one of them is if you have an alias, you're obligated to tell them that. And then if you have, you know, money coming in from anything, you have to tell them that too. Now, I'll be really honest, the amount of money that I make on a book doesn't even crack their limit that they would be looking for. I probably didn't have to tell them that. But you know what? I would rather tell them everything and have them be like, oh God, you're in here again. What now?
Than
them come knocking on my door, because that's never going to be a good day. So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so my whole security team, they all know about it. My boss knows about it because he has to sign up a form for me able to have, you know, alternate employment or off-duty employment. So he knows. And then, of course, my face is on the back of the book. So
yeah, right.
There are people in my squadron that have read the book. I think there actually might be somebody that is actively reading the book, like, right now.
Cool.
You know, like, I don't walk around like, hey, buy my book. I don't talk about it if I don't have to. If somebody directly asks me, hey, is this you? And I've gotten that question before. Somebody, like, shows me the back of the book. I'm not going to lie to them. I'm going to be like, yep, that's me.
Yeah, of course.
And that's about ends at work. Yeah.
It's definitely nothing to be ashamed. It's cool. I think it's cool. But just your job specifically, I think, you know, you've read about that a lot with different people since 2001, especially with trying to get clearances for their books and all that other stuff. So I was just with their respective branches. So I was just curious of your experience of that. So you and you covered that. And then also, of course, you know, it's good to have your fellow crewmates read the book anyway, so they can say, because always the worst for me, it's always guns in movies. So like, you don't need to cock the gun. There's always a round in the chamber, right? Like that thing in the movie where every single time someone comes through the door, they reload a chamber around. And I just think nobody would really do that. And I'm sure you have the same sort of thing in the Air Force.
Yeah. So I've got a very small group of people that they get a chance to like beta read. So they get a chance to read before it goes out for publication. And, you know, like they're my brain trust. I ask them, hey, you know, does this make sense? Do these interactions make sense? Have I misused a military term for some reason? And that's helpful. And then I also have one of my friends. He's my blood and guts guy. So he has worked with JTACs. He has he's also worked with a lot of different medical communities within the military. And you know, so I'll ask him, hey man, like how big is the hole on the other side if somebody gets shot with this size caliber bullet? And he's like, oh man, I don't know, how far back is it? You know, like, and I'll be like, hey, so if I were to exsanguinate somebody, how big a puddle would that make? So no kidding, there's a description of a puddle of blood in the book at one point in time, and it's not his exact description, but like he'd given me like, oh yeah, well it would make a, you know, an avocado shaped pattern, and sure enough I was like, oh yeah, like it's gonna look like an avocado, and you know, like I described it just like that.
Nice. Yeah, so he wrote that for you, that little description for you there. That's great.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Those end up being the really awkward conversations. Hey, bud, can you tell me what would happen if I did this to somebody? It's for the book.
I was going to say, yeah, are you having problems right now? You want to talk about it? You ask those type of questions. Are you all right? That's funny. That's awesome. Well, what's the best way people can follow you, learn about your book, learn about you, whatever you want them to find out about?
I'm probably most active on Twitter. You can find me at author K.R. Paul. You can find me there. And then I'm also on Facebook, same thing, author K.R. Paul. And then the website, everything is all author K.R. Paul.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I'll put those in the show notes, of course, and link that up. And, also best of luck on the next book. So you are, you don't have a firm date yet. What is like sometime this year, next year for the next one?
I'm hoping this year, and talking to Dan, my publisher, also the author of Force No One, great book, by the way.
Yep.
He was shooting me messages on Twitter, like right before we started, actually, I think right as we started. I'm gonna have to go back through them, but if I read one of them correctly, it sounds like Pantheon sequel is next up in the queue. So hopefully by summer.
Nice. Very nice. Well, shoot me a message. I'll be sure to mention that when it comes out. So
yeah, sure thing.
That'll be awesome. Well, Kate, thank you very, very much for your time. I appreciate it. And, best of luck for your books coming through. I'm reading Force No One right now. So I'll definitely give you a mention as well when your book comes through.
All right. Great. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing your story. Appreciate it. Yep. All right.